With the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Taylor Hillman.
It's the end of the week. Good morning. Thanks for joining us. It's Friday, January 12th. There's good news for the almond industry today. The Almond Board of California released the December position report yesterday. The total shipments for the month of December 2017 were 204.5 million pounds. That's compared to roughly 156 million pounds that were shipped in December of 2016. That's an increase of 30.9% between December 2016 and December 2017. Year-to-date shipments are roughly 1,038 million pounds, which is also up 9.23% from last year's roughly 951 million pounds. Crop receipts as of December 31st were roughly 2,207 million pounds, also bringing that up 7.8% from last year's roughly 2,062 million pounds. So the almond industry continues to grow. In national headlines, following his address from the American Farm Bureau Federation earlier this week, President Donald Trump cautioned farmers and ranchers to don't get nervous regarding his efforts to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement. He made the comments during an interview with RFD-TV. In a separate interview with AgriPulse, Trump said, quote, "I'm negotiating tough for the farmers." Trump says he thinks the new NAFTA agreement will, as he says, come out very well for the farmer. However, the president didn't promise to not withdraw from the agreement. And while NAFTA was top of mind for AFBF members during the convention, Trump on Monday had just one line in his address regarding NAFTA, opting to focus on tax reform and regulatory relief. The next round of NAFTA negotiations is set to begin later this month in Canada. AFBF officials believe agriculture issues could be a topic in the next round of negotiations, but stress that automobile-related issues are the main drivers for the renegotiation effort. The American Farm Bureau Federation wrapped up their annual convention with their policy meetings. On Tuesday, delegates set forth their policy priorities for 2018, which of course are things they want to see in the Farm Bill. Michael Clements reports.
Delegates of AFBF in Nashville, Tennessee this week fine-tuned the organization's policy book for the year to include improvements in the Farm Bill. AFBF Public Policy Executive Director Dale Moore says AFBF members want changes to the cotton and dairy programs in the next Farm Bill.
Grassroots delegates from all over the country went through our policy book from the first policy to the last one. They gave us some direction. Here's a handful of things we need you to focus on. Let's get the Farm Bill done. We need some things to tighten up on. Making the cotton programs work better, certainly some attention to the dairy programs, a lot of attention on the working lands conservation programs.
AFBF also seeks an improved agriculture risk coverage program to decrease risk management disparities across counties. Other policies include ending sunsets on trade agreements, labor issues, and ending the use of non-GMO labels on products that do not have GMO alternatives.
They talked about other issues related to the regulatory environment, kind of reeling back in how we make life better for our men and women across the country. And we feel like that what the delegates gave us is policy that says we expect you to work with Congress, expect you to work with the administration to make some progress on reducing that regulatory burden.
Moore says the policy set by AFBF delegates makes a difference in Washington, D.C.
When we take that policy to Washington, the men and women who are elected to represent them from across the country, they know where that policy came from. It's not from Dale Moore sitting in Washington, D.C. It's directly from the boots in the dirt back in their home district.
Delegates also unanimously reelected AFBF President Zippy Duvall to a two-year term. Michael Clements, Nashville.
Back here in California, AgNet West was at the San Joaquin Valley Grape Symposium put on by University of California Cooperative Extension this week, and mating disruption was a hot topic. As AgNet West has reported on before, a new product for mating disruption with vine mealybug is showing great promise. We interviewed Cooperative Extension Entomology Advisor David Haviland a year ago about this practice, and he updated growers this week at the San Joaquin Valley Grape Symposium in Easton. The new product is a sprayable microbiome that are tiny capsules that slowly release pheromone, like a deflating balloon. Haviland said the results from his trials have been impressive, but he understands why growers have a negative opinion about vine mealybug mating disruption with its expensive and inefficient introduction over the last several years. At the symposium, Haviland suggested that growers just try the new product on a small portion of their orchard, maybe 6 or 10 acres if they're interested. Attendees had several questions, including how many applications to make. Haviland suggested monitoring for the pest, then treating once a month after it shows up on traps until 4 weeks before harvest. Now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
McKellar Family Farms in Tulare County is home to over 180 acres of citrus and offers wagon ride tours of the farm as part of their efforts to educate the community on agricultural production. The nonprofit farming operation provides pre-scheduled tours for groups of 15 or more, hosting many school trips and tourists making their way to the sequoias. Social media and marketing coordinator Kelly Lapidula talked about establishing non-scheduled tours for smaller groups.
What we want to do is create this self-guided walking tour where they can experience the farm, they can pick oranges, they can learn about irrigation through an interactive exhibit and learn about the citrus industry. And that's what we're trying to do. One of our biggest needs right now is the support and the funding from the community. We have so many farmers here and so many supportive people, and we just want to be able to share that with the world.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West's Farm City News Day. More agriculture news for you now.
There is still time to register for the 2018 Unified Wine and Grape Symposium, taking place January 23rd through the 25th at the Sacramento Convention Center. In 1995, the American Society for Enology and Viticulture, along with the California Association of Wine Grape Growers, joined together to create the Unified Wine and Grape Symposium, which has now become the largest wine and grape conference in the nation, with nearly 14,000 industry professionals attending. The event will feature speaker presentations, networking opportunities, and an industry trade show featuring 730 booths. The breakout sessions are categorized by areas of interest such as marketing and public relations, grape growing, winemaking, and business and operations. Many of the presentations are also being offered in Spanish. Pre-registration rates are valid through January 16th for this year's Unified Wine and Grape Symposium happening January 23rd through the 25th. Stay with AgNet West for coverage of the event. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Canada has launched a wide-ranging trade dispute against the United States that challenges the U.S. use of anti-dumping and anti-subsidy duties. Canada appeared to be mounting a case on behalf of the rest of the world, since it cited almost 200 examples of alleged U.S. wrongdoing, almost all of them concerning other trade partners, such as China, India, Brazil, and the European Union, this according to Reuters. However, U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer described the dispute as a broad and ill-advised attack on the U.S. trade remedies system. Lighthizer says the claims by Canada are unfounded and could lower U.S. confidence that Canada is committed to mutually beneficial trade. The 32-page complaint focuses on technical details of U.S. trade, including the treatment of export controls to the use of retroactive duties and split decisions by the 6-member U.S. International Trade Commission.
Well, in today's livestock news, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association continues to work on a variety of issues here in 2018, some that they started dealing with last year. One of those is the electronic logging device, or ELD mandate, where a 90-day delay was granted for all delivery haulers, including those that transport livestock and other ag commodities. Colin Woodall, NCBA Senior Vice President of Government Affairs, has an update.
Right now, most commercial truckers are having to comply with the electronic logging devices. However, for agriculture, we were able to buy ourselves a little time in order to address the issue of hours of service, because we know that the ELDs and the hours of service as they exist don't work for live animals being hauled down the road. We can't have these animals sitting on the side of the road. We need them moving in order to keep them comfortable and get them to market as quickly as possible. It truly is an animal welfare issue for us. So we were happy that the Department Department of Transportation understood that and took the action to give us some more time. But now we have to find a way to get more exemptions from DOT in order to make sure that agriculture is treated differently, because a load of cattle is much different than a load of toilet paper. And we need to make sure we can get these animals to market as quickly as possible.
And Woodall says work also continues on a new farm bill.
We know that the current farm bill expires on September 30th of this year. We would like to have a farm bill, a new farm bill in place by then, so everybody can have some certainty on what the rules are going to look like going into the next 5 years. We also know that both the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee and the Senate Agriculture Committee also want to get this bill done. So I think we're going to see a fast push here early in 2018 to have a markup over on the House side to get a new bill passed, and then to really push on the Senate to get theirs done, hopefully by the time we get into the summer. We have to be very careful here because history is not on our side when it comes to getting a farm bill done in time, but with the motivation of the House chairman and the Senate chairman both, we're going to do everything we can to help them be successful in getting this bill done. And that includes protecting the conservation title, protecting the research title, and also establishing a vaccine bank to protect us against foot and mouth disease.
Again, that was National Cattlemen's Beef Association's Colin Woodall. And USDA is encouraging people and groups wanting to protect critical wetlands, ag lands, and grasslands to consider enrolling their property into conservation easements. This year, USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service is planning to invest $250 million in technical and financial assistance to help private landowners, tribes, land trusts, and other groups protect these valuable lands. The Ag Conservation Easement Program, otherwise known as ACEP, focuses on restoring and protecting wetlands as well as conserving productive ag lands and grasslands. Landowners are compensated for enrolling their land in easements. NRCS Acting Chief Leonard Jordan said protecting these lands preserves America's heritage, natural resources, and open space. Easements are also important tools for people who are trying to improve the management of their land. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
In my part of the world, black-eyed peas for dinner on New Year's Day is an old tradition. I guess it was back in the Great Depression of the 1930s. See, each pea in the pot represented a dollar in the upcoming year. Superstitious or not, every stove had a pot of black-eyed peas on for consumption that day. I'm not sure how widespread this custom was, but it was universal in the South. The reasoning? Because the South is where the Depression hit hardest. But here we are almost a century later, and most stores will carry a bigger stock of black-eyed peas than normal in the last 2 weeks of this year. A dollar for every pea in the pot? Well, I never really counted. It's a good vegetable, so who cares? And that's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. I'm Taylor Hillman. In today's interview segment, if you remember, we talked to state conservationist for California, Carlos Suarez, back in October, as he and several representatives from California's Natural Resources and Conservation Service were packing up and heading to assist Puerto Rico with Hurricane Maria recovery. Suarez and the team are still there helping out, and he took some time to update AgNet West on how things are going. Okay, so Carlos, we talked to you before you left for Puerto Rico. You're still in Puerto Rico. You're there doing some hurricane recovery, helping out. Let me ask you, when you first got there, was it what you expected? Was it overwhelming? What was your initial reactions?
Yes, Taylor. I arrived on October 13, 2017. I arrived at the USDA lead for hurricane recovery for Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. And this was an appointment by Secretary Perdue. I'm basically representing Secretary Sonny Perdue in Puerto Rico for recovery efforts. So I'm coordinating all the efforts for all the USDA agencies that operate here in Puerto Rico. So being a native of Puerto Rico and knowing the island before the hurricane, I have to say, yes, that I was quite shocked by what I found. quite frankly, to be honest with you, it was worse than what I have seen in the news. You know, you watch, you know, all the news outlets, and it was constantly showing what was going on in Puerto Rico and the disaster and so forth. But you actually have to be here to actually live what was going, what was truly going on. And unfortunately, at the time, it was worse. I was probably in shock for about the first 7 to 10 days after I arrived to the island.
And we talked about, before you left, we talked about how this would be somewhat personal for you because you are from the island. And so, yeah, I can imagine that that shock was probably a little bit more from you from being from there. We also talked about what you expected you guys would be doing there. Are those some of the jobs you're doing there? Anything, you know, you guys are doing extra? Or what are some examples of what you guys are doing?
As part of my job here as a basically a facilitator or coordinator between all the USDA agencies and the government of Puerto Rico and other federal agencies. I divide my time between our USDA offices in San Juan and also the JFO, or the Joint Field Office Operations, for FEMA. And work varies on a day-to-day basis. It could be NRCS-type work, like conservation practices, doing emergency watershed protection restoration work. Or the next day it could be attending a meeting with Food and Nutrition Services to discuss the food stamp program or the food assistance program here on the island, which is of course managed under USDA, and a lot of other things. Farm Service Agency with their emergency conservation program, rural development and their housing loans. Not only for housing loans, but also for repairs caused by the hurricane. So also working with APHIS, monitoring of coffee plantations coming into the island, working with APHIS Animal Services, too, on the animal mortality that was also caused as a result of a hurricane. So it varies from agency to agency, and my role has been to be a facilitator, a coordinator of our assistance, whether it's financial assistance or technical assistance. And I have to say that there has been an outstanding relationship with the Puerto Rico Department of Agriculture. I meet with the Secretary of Ag for Puerto Rico weekly to discuss progress, and not only on the Commonwealth side, but also on the federal side. And also, that also includes the U.S. Virgin Islands, which I meet with the Commissioner of Agriculture to do similar things as I do it in Puerto Rico.
So your role, you really have your hands on a lot of the recovery efforts, not just on the NRCS side. So that's great to hear. We were talking earlier before we started rolling about some things that may have surprised you. Anything on the island or on in the area that you guys are helping with that you didn't think would take as much work, but it really has, you know, needed help in certain areas? Or maybe the surprise is that everything is kind of, you know, going smoothly so far?
Well, I would say the damage. I would say the extent of the damage, both in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, is substantial. So in some cases, we still are under emergency mode. Half of the island, half of Puerto Rico, a little bit over half of the Puerto Rico still without electricity. So that presents challenges as it relates to working, say, for example, on field offices where our internet service is not working, and looking for ways that we can do things like by hand, like the old-fashioned way, paper and pencil. So that's taking a little bit longer because of those what we're used to in the mainland with the communications and support. In some cases here, it's not available. The other thing, too, is the amount of, I would say, the amount of outreach and the amount of information that we have to share with people here. There's about 15,000 farmers in Puerto Rico that Puerto Rico Department of Ag considers bona fide farmers. So potentially all of them can participate in our programs, yet we still have a little bit over 8,000 that have signed up for programs in our offices. So that means that we still have half of them that we have to reach out to them. So we're doing everything possible to get the word out. And, you know, forget about the internet. We're just doing it the old-fashioned way. We're doing radio. We're doing newspapers. We even hired a van with speakers that goes around the rural areas talking about our program. So we're using every effort possible, every tool in the toolbox to get the word out so that farmers participate of our programs. Yeah.
That was going to be my next question, is kind of how things are looking, how's the state of the area, and if those challenges were there. That's very interesting. So going to the old school ways of getting information out with no internet or electricity in some cases, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I want to reinforce the fact that we have developed an outstanding relationship with the Puerto Rican Department of Agriculture. Secretary Carlos Flores, definitely, he is a leader in agriculture here in Puerto Rico. So working with him closely, and him and his staff, have actually helped us immensely in getting the word out, you know, meeting with farmers, meeting with dairy producers, coffee producers, meeting with other tropical fruit producers and so forth. To get the word out, and slowly but surely, we're starting to see, you know, things turning around. But it's going to be a while. This is not going to be 3 months, 6 months, and we're back in shape. It might take a few years before we can actually get the agriculture and the whole island back in shape. But there's no question that you know, Puerto Ricans and the U.S. Virgin Islanders, they're very resilient. And they are going to move forward and be better than before.
Thank you very much for your time. I know you're busy, and with the time change and everything, I appreciate you making some time for me. And I know you haven't been feeling well. So good luck. Keep going. We're proud of you, and keep up the good work.
Well, thanks, Taylor, and thanks for the opportunity to speak to you. Take care.
This is Farm City News Day by Agnet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Agnet West's Farm City Newsday. More agriculture news for you now. USDA is looking at ways to replace methyl bromide as a pesticide because it reportedly harms the atmosphere's ozone layer. Stephanie Ho has more.
For ag producers, methyl bromide has been a very useful gas.
It's used to fumigate situations, structures, crops, soil, etc.
That was Sunny Ramaswamy, director of the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, who says the gas has been popular because it is easy to use and is very effective.
Methyl bromide itself is really powerful as a pesticide. It can kill insects, it can kill fungi, it can kill bacteria, it can kill nematodes. So as a fumigant, it works really, really well. But the same compound is pretty negatively impactful on the ozone layer.
The ozone layer is important because it protects humans from the sun's ultraviolet rays. The NIFA director says his agency has been funding research to look for alternatives through the Methyl Bromide Transition Program. One project involves getting rid of pests in places where there is a lot of grain.
Now, you got to get the insecticide to kill them in the right place. You know, the traditional insecticides that we use, that one might think of, you know, that a homeowner might spray in the yard or whatever, it doesn't get into those nooks and crannies and those crevices and things like that. That's where these insects are hiding.
So what can people do?
The folks at Kansas State University and the USDA Agricultural Research Service scientists in Manhattan, Kansas, receive funding from us that take insecticides, our traditional insecticides, and they have developed new formulations where they can be aerosolized,
which is how it can reach pests in the nooks and crannies where they are hiding.
A second example that I might share with you is in potato production. Again, we have a lot of biological constraints, various types of pathogens, various types of insects, and nematodes.
Nematodes have been the bane of potato production, especially in the northwestern part of the country. But researchers at Oregon State University and the University of Idaho have found that crucifer plants, like broccoli, are toxic to nematodes.
With funding from NIFA, what scientists have ended up doing is now to figure out how best to get the, you know, sort of rotating those crops and things like that. And so the root exudate, the fluid that comes out of the roots of these crucifers ends up releasing those compounds into the soil. And if you've got leftover nematodes from the previous potato season, those guys are going to be, you know, dead.
The third example involves protecting foods like ham from pests like mites.
Scientists have come up with ways to develop these coatings that you can coat that ham with. These are edible coatings, and you can get them from other fruit and vegetables and plant materials. These are not chemicals.
He says the edible coatings are made from grape must and shrimp shells.
You can coat your apples, or you can coat your pears or whatever. You know how you want to protect those things as well?
NIFA is currently accepting new applications for environmentally friendly alternatives under its methyl bromide transition program. The deadline for applications is January 30th, 2018. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
To get more information on topics you've heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German @BrianAgNetWest and Taylor Hillman @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by AgNet West.